Now let's turn to John chapter 4. John chapter 4, remember we're talking about the incident of the woman at the well, or the conversation that Jesus had with the woman at the well. And chapter 4 actually breaks down into two different parts. It's the woman at the well in verse 1 through 42 that we're currently looking at, and then in verse 43 down on through verse 54, it'll talk about the healing of the nobleman's son. And as we go through these, we're moving in a progression. First, remember, in chapter 3, Jesus had his first conversation that's recorded in John, and that conversation was with Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a Pharisee. He was a Jew of Jews, a very religious, devout Jewish man that was a Pharisee. And now, as he comes to the Samaritan woman at the well, she would be considered half Jewish because she was Samaritan. They weren't considered full Jews. They were considered kind of half Jews. And when we get down to the nobleman's son, we'll see that may well have been a Gentile. So we're seeing a progression from religious to, and we'll see tonight that the woman at the well was not what you would call a devout, probably, person, but when we talk about her five husbands. But it's a progression, and he's moving outwards and onwards now with his ministry. Remember, we noticed the transition last time in chapter 4, verse 1 through 6, and the transition is from Judea to Galilee. In verse 3, it says, he left Judea and went away again into Galilee. So he says it's necessary in verse 4, and he had to pass through Samaria. And that word had is that word that means it was an absolute necessity. And we notice that actually it wasn't a geographical necessity. He's going from Judea here down to Galilee up here, and Samaria is indeed between them. But there were hostilities or bad feelings, bad blood, if you will, between Jews and Samaritans. So what a devout Jew would do would be he would cross the Jordan River and go up this way to get to Galilee. He would not go through Samaria. So it wasn't geographically necessary for Jesus to go through Samaria, but it was necessary because he had to speak to the woman at the well. So this is an incident that God had planned. It wasn't something that just kind of happened. Jesus is doing God's will. So there's the transition from Judea to Galilee. Now we have the conversation in verse 7 through actually 26. We got through verse 15 last time. And we found out some things about this Samaritan woman. And the first one was, in verse 9, we noted that she was resentful. Verse 9 says, therefore, the Samaritan woman said to him, how is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink, since I am a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. So she was somewhat resentful of his request to do her a favor, and possibly he asked her for that favor when he asked her to get him some water, that he was trying to defuse this animosity between the Jews and Samaritans by asking her to do him a favor. Women were treated very lightly in this day. And you'll notice, in fact, down in verse 27, and we'll talk about this a little more as we go through this section. But at verse 27, when his disciples came back, he was alone at the well talking to this woman. When the disciples came, and they were amazed that he had been speaking with a woman. And when we get to that verse, we'll notice that that word is very emphatic. They were amazed. Here was Jesus, a Jewish man, talking to a Samaritan woman, having a conversation with her. And we'll see why that was so amazing as we go through this context. But notice for now, she was somewhat resentful. She was ignorant spiritually. In verse 10, it says, Jesus answered and said to her, if you knew the gift of God, and the way this is phrased in the Greek is what's called a second-class conditional clause. And what that means is it expects a negative. So it could be translated, if you knew the gift of God and you don't. So he's telling her flat out she's ignorant of spiritual matters. And who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. In other words, what he's saying, if you would have known the implications of who I am, you would have asked first. You wouldn't have waited for me to ask. So she was spiritually ignorant. Her concern was completely pragmatic. It was for her own convenience. Verse 15, when she answers, it says, the woman said to him, sir, give me this water, so I will not be thirsty, nor come all the way here to draw. So she was being just looking out for her own convenience at that point. And as we see, as we pick up tonight and start talking about her husband's situation, that she's going to become very defensive. And we'll see that. She's going to try and change the subject when Jesus brings it up. She's going to be very curt when he asks her to get her husband, and she will become defensive. So let's start now. The woman and her husbands, or her situation with husbands, in verse 15 through 19, and verse 15 kind of overlaps there. We had it last week, and we'll start with it this week. Let's read those verses. Verse 15 says, the woman said to him, sir, give me this water, so I will not be thirsty, nor come all the way here to draw. He said to her, go, call your husband and come here. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you have correctly said, I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one with whom you now have is not your husband. This you have said truly. The woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. So up to this point, the woman probably wasn't too serious. Just a guy coming along. She probably thought he was maybe slightly crazy, and she was humoring him. But now he's going to ask an embarrassing question. He's going to say, or he does say, in verse 16, he says, go, call your husband, and come here. So he asked her to go get her husband. Well, in verse 15, we noted the woman continued to misunderstand what he was saying. She was keeping things strictly on a material level. And her primary interest, again, was, well, give me this water you're talking about. And, of course, he's talking about spiritual water, as we had in verse 13, when he said, everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again. That's the water in the well. But whoever drinks of the water that I will give him shall never thirst. So he's talking about something other than just water from the well. But her interest is, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I didn't have to come back to this well every day and get water? He said, if I have this water, I'll never thirst again. I won't have to come back here. So her response is completely on the physical plane. Whether she sees more or not, if she does, she doesn't admit to it. Now, this response is going to be repeated. We'll see it several times. We'll see the disciples themselves do the same thing. Look down at verse 32. In verse 31, it says, meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, saying, Rabbi, eat. But he said to them, I have food to eat that you do not know about. So what was the disciples' response? So the disciples were saying to one another, no one brought him anything to eat, did he? So he was talking about something other than a sandwich. And they kept it on the material level. They didn't see past that, just like the woman at the well. And if you look at chapter 6 and verse 30, we'll see the Galileans do exactly the same thing. 6:30 says, So they said to him, "What then do you do for a sign, that we may see and believe you? What work do you perform? Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread out of heaven to eat." Jesus then said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, it is not Moses who has given you the bread out of heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread out of heaven. For the bread of God is that which comes down out of heaven and gives life to the world." Well, who's he talking about? He's talking about himself there. But they say, then they said to him, "Lord, always give us this bread." Wow, cool. I won't have to work for bread anymore. Get it free. And then in verse 35, he corrects them and he says, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will not hunger, and he who believes in me will never thirst." So we'll see again and again, Jesus talks about spiritual things, and the people he's talking to just take that as material things. So now he challenges her in verse 16, and he makes that request that we read a moment ago. He said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." Now, this request was not probably surprising to her. It may be to us. It seems out of context, doesn't it? Here he's having this conversation with the woman at the well, and he says, "Go get your husband and come back." It seems strange to us, but in their culture, they saw things a little differently. In fact, the rabbis had a somewhat strange, unrealistic view of man-woman relationships. Let me read a couple of things that the rabbis said about men and women. One of them is this: "A man shall not be alone with a woman at an inn, not even with his sister or his daughter." Why? On account of what men may think. And that's what the rabbi said. So a devout Jewish man would not even go to an inn with his sister or his daughter. That was because people might talk. But here's the one that's more applicable to the situation at hand. It says this: "A man shall not talk with a woman in the street, not even with his own wife, and especially with another woman, on account of what men may say." So they were so concerned with appearances that they wouldn't even have a conversation with their own wife on the street. So here's Jesus talking to this woman at the well. He says, "Go get your husband." That wouldn't have been a really surprising request to the woman because, I mean, it was commonplace. That's why in verse 27, remember we looked at verse 27 when the disciples came back and they were shocked. It says at this point that his disciples came and they were amazed that he had been speaking with a woman. They were, wow, I mean, you know, devout Jewish people just don't do this. Now, he wasn't concerned about what people might think. That's not why he asked her to go get her husband, even though his request might not have been so surprising. He was taking advantage of an opportunity here. And that opportunity was to show this woman her need of salvation. When she responds, the first part of verse 17, we'll see she gets really defensive. Verse 17, "The woman answered and said, 'I have no husband.'" Boink. See how curt that is? How, I mean, she uses as few words as possible. "I don't have a husband." And then she goes on to say, or Jesus said, "You have correctly said, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands." So she tries to change the subject. "Well, I don't have a husband." She figures that'll be the end of it. And she doesn't want to look at the real issue here. And she thinks this is just a stranger. He doesn't know me from anybody else. He won't know my situation. So she just says, "I don't have a husband." Well, Jesus' reply kind of puts her back because he knows all about her marital one commentator said marital misadventures. I'll make a note on Jewish law here. We should keep this in mind. Remember, we're in a different culture than our own. Under Jewish law, and Samaritan law, a woman could not divorce her husband. That was not permitted. But they did have a way out. It wasn't as bad as it seems on the surface. They had a way out, and that was, under certain circumstances, she could go to court and have her husband compelled to divorce her. I mean, she could go and say, you know, this guy beats me every day. Well, maybe that wouldn't be a good enough reason for them. I don't know what their reasons were, but there was recourse for a woman. She couldn't divorce her husband, but she could have the court make her husband divorce her. There were also incidents where women would pay their husbands to divorce them, or perform services. I'll be your maid for 5 years if you let me out of this type of deal, arrangement. So there were ways that a woman could officially become divorced from a husband. But you know, in theory, there was no limit to the number of times a woman might remarry after a valid, you might call it, divorce. But even if that was the case, Jesus still knew that the guy she was living with now wasn't her husband. So he still had her. I mean, he's showing her that she needs something here. She's living with a man now who is not her husband. And that's verse 18. For you have had 5 husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. This you have said truly. So she's living with a guy. Yeah, technically what you said is correct. You don't have a husband, but you have a little history. And you are living with a guy that isn't your husband. So what is her conclusion? First, it forces the woman to realize this isn't just some stranger passing by who might be a little bit addle-pated. You know, this guy knows all about my background. And I never met him before. I don't know him. He doesn't know me. And he knows all about my background. So she comes to the conclusion that he's a prophet. Verse 19, the woman said to him, Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. And here she is changing the subject again. You notice how she does this? He starts talking about her husband. He says, oh, you must be a prophet. Let's talk about that for a while. Now, if you look back at Luke chapter 7, you see why she might have thought that. There was a common conception that a prophet could see a person's personal condition. They had insights beyond normal people, so to speak. In Luke chapter 7, verse 39, you see that. It says, Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, If this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of a person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. So you see, they had this conception that if you were a prophet, you would know these things. So that's why the Samaritan woman thought he was a prophet. Keep in mind something here. This goes a little further than it looks like on the surface. Remember, the Samaritans didn't believe exactly the same way the Jews did. They only believed in the first 5 books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. And they believed that the only prophet to that point had been Moses, because they didn't believe in the prophetic books as sacred. They didn't believe in the wisdom books. They didn't believe in the historical books, just the Pentateuch, the first 5 books. And they thought that Moses was the prophet of the Pentateuch and that he would be succeeded by the next prophet who would be the Messiah. So she is already speculating that he might be the Messiah. See, this goes a little further if you look at her background, because she's a Samaritan and she believed that Moses would be succeeded by the next prophet who would be the Messiah. So she's saying a little bit more than he's just a prophet. She's kind of speculating already. Now we come to the worship issue in verse 20 through 26. And this is going to be how she's going to change the subject again. And she's going to bring up something else. Let's read those verses. Starting at 20, It says, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be his worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us. Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. And this is a very dramatic statement of his messiahship. In fact, it's very rare when Jesus would actually say, I am the Messiah. So this is kind of a big deal. Let's go back to verse 20 and take this in detail. She brings up a controversial topic, and that topic is, where is the right place to worship? Where's the really true place of worship? She's being defensive again. She's trying to change the subject, and she brings up a controversial issue. Maybe she thinks she can start an argument to get the subject away from her husband. But anyway, there was a bitter division between the Jews and the Samaritans as to where the true place of worship was. Now, the Samaritan position was that the proper place to worship was at Mount Gerizim. Now, that's in Samaria, of course, you might have guessed. Here's a map. You can't hardly read that red anyway. Here it is, anyway. See, it's right adjacent to Shechem here, right next to it. Look back at Genesis 12. You can see where they came up with this. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 6 and 7. Verse 6 says, Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem and to the oak of Moreh. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your descendants I will give this land. So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. So Abraham built an altar here in Shechem, which is adjacent to the mountain. So they thought that this was ample biblical evidence that that's where the true place of worship should be. And in fact, they held that this is where Abraham offered up Isaac. That was their position. So that was their view. The Jews, of course, thought that Jerusalem was the proper place to worship. Look at Deuteronomy 12. The fact is that the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, does not specifically mention Jerusalem as the place to worship. Deuteronomy 12:5 says, but you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. So it doesn't say specifically. It just says God is going to tell you. Now if you look at 2 Chronicles chapter 6, starting at verse 5, 2 Chronicles 6:5 says, since the day that I brought my people from the land of Egypt, I did not choose a city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house that my name might be there, nor did I choose any man for a leader over my people Israel. But I have chosen Jerusalem that my name might be there, and I have chosen David to be over my people Israel. Now it was in the heart of my father David to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. Second Chronicles is quite clear that Jerusalem is the place that God chose. So why didn't the Samaritans see that? Second Chronicles isn't in the Pentateuch. It's not one of the first five books. They discounted it. They only took the first five books of the Bible to be inspired. This passage meant nothing to them. Well, this dispute was quite bitter. And in fact, let me read a comment about an event that is recorded historically. And what was happening here was that there was a Jew going up to Jerusalem to pray. And he was walking past the plane tree by Gerizim, where a Samaritan found him. He said to him, "Where are you going?" He answered, "I'm going up to Jerusalem to pray." The former said, "Would it not be better for you to pray in this blessed mountain rather than in that dunghill?" So see, they got kind of hot about this. This was kind of one of those buttons that you push to get an argument going. So that's what the Samaritan woman is doing. She's trying to push this button to get an argument. Jesus does not argue with her. He doesn't get involved with an argument. Instead, he takes the question to a little higher level. Notice he doesn't compromise here. He tells her flat out that Samaritan worship is somewhat confused. You know, the Samaritans believed in deities other than the true God. Their concept of God was somewhat twisted, and that was because they rejected most of the Old Testament. You know, they didn't believe the Psalms, the historical books, the prophets. So they had a limited view of who God was. And Jesus notes this in verse 22. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. The word salvation there in verse 22, we should note, in the Greek text has a definite article. It doesn't say salvation is from the Jews. It says the salvation is from the Jews. It has the definite article. Only true salvation, the true salvation, the real salvation is through the Jews or from the Jews. So he says, we worship what we know, and what we know points back to the entire Old Testament. So he's not compromising his doctrine here for this woman. He doesn't do that, yet he doesn't argue with her. He goes on. He reveals to her the reality of worship in verse 23 and 24. 23 says, "But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be His worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship Him in spirit and truth." The reality of worship is, it's not about a place. And all this argument is fruitless, because true worship isn't about where you are. It's not a matter of being in the right place. It's a matter of having the right attitude. In other words, true worship is not external. It's internal. And that's what he's telling this woman, rather than argue with her, that true worship is about a mental attitude. When he says God is spirit in verse 24, that points out that God's nature is incorporeal, if I can use a two-bit word. In other words, He's not bound to any place. He's everywhere. God isn't bound to this mountain, that mountain, and true worship is internal and not external. In verse 24, he says, "And those who worship Him must worship in spirit and truth." The word must is that little word day in Greek that we've had several times lately that points to an absolute necessity. So it's absolutely necessary in true worship to understand that true worship is not connected to a place, but to an attitude. It's not connected to the external things. It's connected to internal things. Your attitude towards truth, towards doctrine. Now in verse 25 and 26, Jesus identifies himself. In verse 25, he says, or the woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When that one comes, he will declare all things to us." Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." Now this, in fact, is the most direct statement that Jesus makes prior to his trials about his messiahship. When we look at the Gospels, evidence of his messiahship is everywhere. That's abundant. But actual direct claims by him of being Messiah is very rare. And it's rare for two reasons. The first one is that Jesus did not want a premature conflict with the Jewish authorities. He wouldn't come right out and say it because that would cause conflict with Jewish authorities. Remember last time we noted that God's sovereignty and human means go hand in hand. They're not contradictory. So Jesus didn't say he was Messiah, so he wouldn't start something that he didn't want to start yet. So he waited till later. So you don't see too many claims. The other is he didn't want all of the false political implications. Remember, the Jews reading the Old Testament and reading about Messiah didn't distinguish the first and second advent. So when they saw Messiah or thought about Messiah, what they thought about was he's going to free us from Roman domination. He's a political Messiah. Well, this will happen, but not at the first advent. It'll happen at the second advent. So he didn't want to get that all started. So very rarely does he ever say, "I am the Messiah." But he does here, so it's very important. Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." Now, I think I'll stop here because this is our breaking point. Verse 27 starts with the outcome of this conversation, and that'll go on down through verse 42. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for this record that we have of your conversation with the Samaritan woman at the well. And we pray that as we study this, that we can see the full implications of what's being said and that we can believe it. And Father, we pray that we can use what we know and believe to lead a life that's pleasing to you. In Christ's name, amen.